Welcome back to Talking Talmud. I'm Ann Gordon here with my friend and chavruta Yair Dana Osband. Our daf of the day, Masechet Bava Metzia, daf Nun Zayin, page 57. So we're still talking about the kind of the exemptions to when you could have ona, where you'd say nobody can take advantage of another person in this case because there's no such application of taking advantage of another party in these cases. So Amarava. Amar Rav Chasa by Rav Rabbi Ami, ona ein lahem, where he says, like specifically, we don't have, they're not subject to ona, to exploitation. Bitul mecha chayesh lahem, o ein lahem. So when you're going to say you don't have such a thing as exploitation, remember that exploitation carries the right of the consumer to come back to the seller and say, listen, you know, this was a bad deal, you know, and I'm out. And so the question then is, can you cancel the mekach? Can you cancel the transaction if there was no, like, if there's no cause, right? There's no reason to come and accuse the seller of having done something wrong. Can you then, can the purchaser then say, no, I'm going to cancel this in any case or not? Right, and then this is the beginning of the question. Amar Rav Nachman Hadar, Amar Rav Chasa Pashit Rabbi Ami. So they it seems that they that Rav Nachman says, or Rav Chasa said, then that Rabbi Ami resolved this whole issue. Right, it was at the beginning. The first statement was that Rava said that Rav Chasa said that Rabbi Ami had raised the dilemma, and Rav Nachman now says that Rav Chasa said that Rabbi Ami resolved it. So there's a certain amount of, you know, saying over the law in the name of those who are puzzling it out, and this is where we're up to. Ona ein lahem. So we don't, these cases do not have ona, they do not have, there's no factor of potential being taken advantage of. Bitul mekach yesh lahem, but in fact you could cancel the transaction. Rabbi Yonah Amar, Akdeshot. And for example, right, what kind of thing is this? Specifically talking about consecrated property. Why? Rabbi Yirmiyah Amar Akarkaot. So Rabbi Yirmiyah says, even like, because once you've established that there's such a thing that you can, you don't have ona'ah, you don't have exploitation, but you still can cancel the transaction. So where would that kind of divide, where does that apply? So Rabbi Yoni says that consecrated property. Rabbi Yirmiyah says land. And both of them say in the name of Rabbi Yochanan that these kinds of transactions, again, are not subject to exploitation. It's just irrelevant. And they do still carry with them the possibility of nullifying the transaction. The consecrated property, of course, is going to get much more attention throughout the rest of the daf. I just want to say one more bit here from the Gemara. Manda marak deshot, right? The Gemara says, the one who says that we're talking about consecrated property, and this also attests to kind of the structural configuration of the Gemara, because didn't we just read this a moment ago, and we know that it's Rabbi Yonah, except for that when they're putting the Gemara together in all of its component parts, like this statement wasn't necessarily immediately after the previous statement. So it's not that Rabbi Yonah was just on the tip of their tongues and they forgot. It was that it was a, oh yeah, you know, somebody had that position that it was about consecrated property. So according to the person who says, which we know to be Rabbi Yonah, that it was a consecrated property, kol shekein akarkaot, meaning once you've established that these terms apply or don't apply and do apply to consecrated property, you can infer the application to land. Mandamara karkaot, aval hekdeshot lo, but the reverse does not apply, meaning Rabbi Yirmiyah, who says it applies to land, you can't then automatically infer hekdesh, that it would also be relevant with regard to hekdesh, just because it's about land. The arrow, the implication arrow from hekdesh to land, from consecrated property to land, does not reverse. It does not say from land, you can't say from land also we could then infer consecrated property. And this is, again, to line up with the opinion of Shmuel. Shmuel says that consecrated property could be worth 100 dinar, that you can then desacralize it and put it onto a coin that's worth one pruta, that's going to work. Meaning, you take that kedusha and you do You remove the kedusha and you transfer whatever, but the since we're going to say then the consecrated property is not subject to halachot, to the taking advantage of somebody, then we're going to say that you could desacralize any amount on any amount without worrying about it. That you don't have to worry that this is a matter of exploitation. The point being that Shmuel negated the issue of exploitation with regard to Hekdesh, and so too did this whole passage above. Yerdan, I know you want to talk more about this.
Yeah, I think one of the things that's interesting on this daf is, to me, there was a whole discussion about whether or not the prohibition of interest, right, what we call rebate, actually applies to the treasury of the temple. And I think some of what's interesting about this daf in general is it's sort of, I think, explaining to us that there's kind of the halachic economic system for Jews, right, presumably living in Eretz Israel. And then there's kind of like the halachic economic system of the temple, which seems to have its own rules and regulations.
Yeah, I think that's true. I think some of this feels like they know it and now we're going to talk about it, as opposed to learning it or deriving it for the first time.
Oh, that I would agree with you. Right. Like, it's all new to us, but it's interesting to see that it's like we sort of see they function differently. So on Amud Bet, there's going to be a discussion about, you know, this issue of interest. It's based on the brisa that's quoted on this daf, right? Rebus to Hekdesh Hechidami. How can you have a case of interest involving the temple treasury? So the first way they want to explain this is Imale de Uz Fe. Gizbar mea b'mea b'esrim. So maybe you could say it's that the temple treasurer lends a private person 100 coins, right, that belong to the temple, and the repayment that they arrange is 120 coins, right? So that is exactly what interest would be, right? That, in other words, you lend somebody $100 and you say you owe me back $120. So they're saying this example with the temple. Maybe the reason for that is because, you know, you would think, you know, you don't want to mistakenly believe, right, that you were actually allowed to lend temple money. But hello, may al hagizbar, for it's, is it not true that in the case, the treasurer has committed me'ila, actually, right? How could he lend money to somebody that belonged to the temple? That's exactly what me'ila is, right? Me'ila is, we're talking about, is benefiting from temple property in a way that it wasn't intended to be used. V'kevan shem al ha-gizbar yatsuma atav l'chulin. Once the treasurer committed me'ila, those coins actually become deconsecrated. V'havaluhu tehejod. And then they belong to a private person, meaning to the treasurer. So you couldn't even say that. There's no way that he can take interest on them because it belongs to a private person. They're not even part of the temple anymore. So you can't say that the case is that the temple is taking interest. So now they're going to give another case that maybe this would be the case. I'm a Rabbi Hoshea. So Rabbi Hoshea said, "Hacha b'mayaskina." What's the case that we're dealing with? Kugon shekibel alav l'sapek slatot me arba. It's a case where somebody agreed to supply fine flour from a lot of flour, a lot priced at 4 seas per sella. But amdu mishalosh, and then the price of flour goes up so that it becomes 3 seas per sella. Kidatani, as it was taught in a brisa, hamikabel alav l'sapek selatot me'arba. If somebody commits himself to supply fine flour to the temple from, you know, flour that was priced at 4 seas per sella, v'amdu b'shlosha, and then the price goes up, so the flour really should be 3 seas per sella, right? It becomes more expensive. Misapek me'arba. He still has to supply the flour at the original price of 4 seas per sella, mishalosh v'amdu me'arba. But let's say he agreed to supply flour for 3 seas per sella, and then the price of the flour goes down, so now it becomes 4 seas per sella, misapek me'arba. Then he also needs to supply it by 4. In other words, either way, the person supplying it sort of like has to do what's economically best for the temple. Sheyad Hekdesh al ha'anyoda, because the temple treasury always has the upper hand. So this shows that the temple treasury is not, we don't worry about interest, right? They're actually allowed to fiddle around with the price of the flour, essentially, because they're the Elyonah. They get the they have the upper hand. Now they're going to give a second case of this. Rav Papa Amar, Hachaba Avnei Binyan HaMisarot LeGinsbar Askinan. Okay, we're talking about stones that are used for temple construction, which then were given to the temple treasurer before they were actually consecrated. And so maybe what the Bryce is teaching us is that maybe the treasurer can lend such stones for interest. Kids of Shmuel, like Shmuel said to Amr Shmuel, because Shmuel said, Bonin Bahul, they build the temple structures with non-sacred stones, but Achar Kach Mikadshin. And then afterwards, they are Mikadesh Otam. So in other words, Shmuel basically saying the way the temple, the way the Mikdash would buy construction materials is different than how they would buy other materials. Usually when the temple would make purchases, they would pay in cash. And then that sort of transfers the sanctity of the temple's money onto the item being purchased. But if you're using a construction material which was consecrated as soon as it was purchased, then it's possible that people could actually commit me'ilah during construction, because let's say they sit on the material, they do something else with it, because you know what a construction site is like. You're not treating it as respectfully as you would treat the building itself. So in order to make sure that wouldn't happen, they wouldn't pay cash. Instead, they would buy them on credit, essentially, so that the materials would remain not consecrated during the construction. And only after the materials were fully used, then the temple would pay for them, and that would consecrate them. So if somebody donated stones to the temple, right, he wouldn't actually donate them until after they were used. This is what some of the Mefarshim explain. And so therefore, the materials used for the temple in construction are always not considered to be Hegdesh, and even though they technically are sort of like owned by the temple. Okay? So that's sort of like another way where you're not worried. So basically these are two cases where essentially interest can be taken from these transactions with the temple. In both of the cases, right, the temple can collect some type of interest, right? In other words, if the price of flour changes, right, the temple is allowed to get the higher interest. If, let's say, the price of the construction materials change, right, the temple is allowed to get sort of the higher amount. Even though it looks, but we're saying that because it's a temple and it's not the individual, therefore we don't actually consider it to be interest. So I think, to me at least, this was like an interesting discussion of sort of like how the economics of the temple are just totally different. That we sort of allow this purchasing power in the temple that can look like interest even, but because it's not the individual and it's actually the temple, that's why it's allowed. And also, I just thought this whole thing about how they bought construction material to be very, very interesting, that you had to make sure it was non-hegdesh until you actually built the structure itself, because you're worried that somebody could misuse it, which makes sense. You see what people are like at a construction site. It wouldn't be treated the way that it needed to be treated. You could see how people could forget that you were dealing with something hegdesh, so it's just easier not to make it hegdesh until it's actually finally built.
Should I point out that the way we've done in previous Masechtot, that this was not current events for the Tanaim and Amarayim,
oh,
right?
Of course, I'm upset I didn't point it out, so thank you for you pointing it out. Right.
Right.
Like there's something so detailed here that hundreds of years later, it's interesting that they still knew it and knew it this well.
Right, exactly, that they knew it so well, and that it's so live, like they know the distinction between hektesh versus, you know, regular purchase power.
Exactly. And I think, right, and I wonder how this Masorah was actually sort of like transmitted down to them, because like you said, this was not anything that was done relevantly, and we're quoting Amorayim here. I mean, this really is hundreds of years later.
That's our DAF discussion for the day. Thank you for joining us. Rank us, review us where you get your podcast. Come talk to us on our Facebook page and tell us what you think of this DAF. Thank you to Rabbi Michelle Farber for hosting us on the Hanuman website. And until tomorrow, go and learn.